I really hate these talks. Every time I do one, which isn't all that often, I have a feeling after I've prepared it that that's so obvious. Why am I wasting people's time? You know, it makes me think of that thing that Woody Allen says about who'd want to belong to a club that would invite me. You know? I want to talk tonight about a recent experience I've been having and what it's led me to think about in terms of our practice. But the experience is that I've just started about 6 months ago going down to Soledad Prison to teach meditation to the prisoners. Richard Shankman, who has talked here on a number of occasions, is actually the energizing force behind this project, and it's been going on for a couple of years, and I just have just started with it, and so he should probably be here giving this talk, but he's not. So, I've been interested in the idea of teaching meditation in prison for a long time because it seems like such an obviously good idea. A fellow named Bo Lazoff wrote a book a number of years ago called We're All Doing Time, and which is based on his own experiences with a prison meditation program that he's been doing on the East Coast for a long, long time. So that's what sort of got me started to have an interest in the idea, and then Richard presented me with the opportunity, so I decided to do it. But I had a whole lot of ideas about what it was going to be like. I hadn't even really realized how completely firmly I had built a picture of what prison was like from all sorts of external inputs. We all know about the movies, books, all of the media. I even spent one night in a drunk tank years and years ago after a Christmas party, so I had my own personal experience with what prison was like, so I knew a lot. And when I got down there to the prison, absolutely nothing was like what I expected, which is a good lesson in itself. I also was very anxious about whether I could, in fact, offer anything to these guys. I didn't really know anything about prison, although I actually thought I knew a lot. I didn't know anything, and I didn't know how in the world, as a person who'd lived their whole life on the outside, could say anything meaningful to these guys about how to use Buddhist practice in prison life. That also was a made-up story. It's just not true. I thought I'd like to flesh this out a little bit. One of the most striking experiences was that, or is, that this, Soledad has about actually four facilities. There's a maximum security facility, which is about 4,000 prisoners, in 1,000 in each of 4 yards, and we have a class in 2 of those 4 yards, and the other 2 we hope to have classes in, but we don't yet. And then there's a level 2 prison, which is some countless number of prisoners. I don't know how many are in that prison, but I think I'm going to guess somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000. And that's a level 2 prison. Those prisoners actually have hopes of eventually being out of prison, which very few of the prisoners in the level 4 prison have that hope. Or I should say have that as a realistic hope. All of the prisoners wear the same clothing. I think they all have the same barber. There are obviously lots and lots of rules about how long your hair can be. It can be shaved, but it can't be very long. So they all look exactly the same, except that they're a different ethnic background. There are, I would say, mostly blacks and Hispanics, some Asians, and a few whites in the prison population. And the guard population has about the same kind of makeup. Most of the prisoners who come to this program are volunteers. They actually have to exert considerable effort to make the thing work for them, so they're not casual about it. We have about 100, altogether 100 students out of this potential, out of this population of some perhaps 10,000. So it's maybe 1% of the population is coming to this class. I have no idea what the other 99% of the population does. I don't know for this class itself, for these guys, how many are coming because they're really interested in Buddhism or in meditation, how many are coming because it's an opportunity to do something besides sit in their cell, how many are coming because some of the volunteers that work with me are women, and this is perhaps the only opportunity they have to see a woman ever, except the guards. There are a few women guards. So there are lots of possibilities. I don't know the answers to any of these questions. And that's part of the point of my talk, is that I don't really know anything about what's going on down there. I don't know what the social codes are for the prisoners. How does one survive in prison? There are gangs. Not everyone belongs to them. So there apparently are ways to not be in gangs. I don't know anything about what those ways are. I don't know of the students that we have if any of them are in gangs or if all of them are in gangs. That isn't what we talk about. But so it's a pretty astounding experience on my part to be in a situation one day a week where I know absolutely nothing about what's going on, and nor do I have any hopes of really understanding what's going on or any particular desire, actually. It doesn't really seem particularly relevant to everything that comes up in discussion gets discussed quite thoroughly, but if it doesn't come up in discussion, it doesn't seem important. And so the prisoners are setting the discussion agenda for the most part, and then as teachers, we're responding to that with our thoughts about how the practice can be utilized to deal with the particular problem that's being discussed at the time. So there's very little information about how these prisoners got there, how long they've been there, what their hopes of parole are. I do know that there are a few of them who have talked about their situations, and there are some of our students are serving consecutive life sentences. Some of them have clearly killed people from things they've said. But that's about all I know. And my feeling of personal safety there is a great deal higher than it is outside. The level of the social civility that goes on in the prison is so far in exceeding what goes on outside that it's really astounding. Everyone is extremely polite to each other, thoughtful, courteous, warm. One of the prisoners remarked to me that when he first came to prison, his cellmate, who was a much older man, said, "You'll make the best friends you ever had in your life in prison." And he dismissed it as an outrageous statement at the time, but he's come to find that it's true. And I can very much understand that point of view in terms of my own interactions with these guys. I can't add up how it is in my experience with these guys and the fact that they are in prison for life. There's something about this whole process. It just doesn't add up. A lot of these guys now are in their 40s. They've probably been there since they were teenagers for some crime they did, when perhaps a gang-related crime. Who knows? I don't know. Occasionally something is said in passing that gives you a glimpse into something that suggests that they're not the same people that were sent to jail, and yet they will probably, most of them, pay for this for the rest of their lives, that transgression of their childhood. And at least that's my sense of a number of the guys who are coming to this class. Now, I can't say anything about the 99% of the prisoners who I don't see. I can say very little about these guys. It's one of the things that strikes me over and over again about my experience there is that prison is a perfect place to practice. I mean, you have it's better designed than a retreat is. You have no control over your life. I mean, at a retreat, you can at least decide. You have some choices about food. In prison, you get fed minimally, so I suspect that in general, prisoners eat all that they're given, whatever it is, because it's not enough, especially for the guys who are larger. They talk about the physically bigger guys talk about the diet as being inadequate. So you don't have any control over any of your daily circumstances. You don't have any control over who your cellmate is. You have no privacy. The guards seem to make sure of that. You actually in your cell at the maximum security prison, you're in a cell with a small window, and the prisoners who actually put their towels over the window so they can have at least visual privacy. I don't know if there are surveillance cameras in the cells. I'd be surprised if there aren't. After all, it is a maximum security prison, but at least they have the privacy from people walking by and looking in the door. But when you go to the shower, there are about in one cell building there are 100 prisoners, and there are, I think, 4 showers, and so they have a schedule for using the shower. And in the shower is open, it's open barred door that you stand in public view while you shower, so you're in full view of the guards. And if you hang your towel up, the prisoners tell me if they hang their towel up to get some privacy, the guards will make them take it down. So there's really this constant impingement on their lives that they have to deal with, that brings this practice up on a continuing basis, I think, minute after minute, day after day, if they're able to use it. And this is, the discussions are a lot about these things that do come up and how to work with those things. I think the ones that suffer the most, at least as evidenced by the discussion groups, are those who have a very heightened sense of fair play. That gets beat up pretty badly. There are obviously, one would expect there'd be some guards who would like the opportunities to basically say no, even to reasonable requests, and then the prisoners are so powerless that they come to the meetings full of resentment. And so this is one place that we really spend a lot of time talking about. There's a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh that I want to read that's seems to me particularly appropriate for prison life. and also for our lives. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no escape from old age. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no escape from ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no escape from death. And now, my actions are my only true belongings. There is no escape from the consequences of my actions. They are the ground on which I stand. And this is true for all of us, but it's so blatantly obvious in prison that this is true. These prisoners have been stripped of all of their belongings, except TV sets, if you could think of that as being a good idea. They do have TV sets in their cells, and they can have books, and that's it. And they're stripped of all of the power over their lives. And they are living out the consequences of their actions. But the thing that I want to bring out of prison to this group is that I'm kind of shocked in my own evaluation of my own made-up stories about what prison is like, which now that I've been there for 6 months, I realize I don't know anything about what it's like. But before I went, I thought I knew all of this stuff about what it was like. And that somehow in our lives, we spend an enormous amount, maybe it's just me, but there seems to be a whole industry of visual appearance out there that suggests that a lot of us do this. A lot of us make up substantial parts of our stories about things from the visual inputs we get, from the verbal inputs we get. And so, in fact, we are making up our whole existence and the existences of all those around us based on very inadequate information. And it's only when I'm brought up against this situation in prison where everyone's wearing the same clothing that I become so struck by my own habitual story building. And what I noticed about myself in the prison situation is that when all of these guys wear the same clothing every day and have the same shave and haircut every day, I mean, they look exactly the same every day. My mind actually has stopped making up these stories with respect to these guys. But when I come back outside, my mind goes right back to making up the stories. So this is such a deep habit that I have that seems not only futile, but it actually gets in the way of clear seeing and understanding. And my mind insists on doing it. I mean, we've all had the experience of seeing something in the distance that we think at first is a bird, and then it does something that's not bird-like, and then we realize, oh, it's just a cluster of leaves. And we're able to actually find ourselves having made the mistake, and there's a period in which the mind clings desperately to that image that it's a bird until it finally has to give it up because it's faced with too much evidence that it's only a twig with leaves on it. But the mind is very reluctant to admit the error and take on the new identification. You know, what is that in us that's like that? That not only over and over and over again discovers that it's building incorrect stories, and then keeps on doing it over and over and over again. So that's my question. Would anyone like to add to that?
Mm-hmm. feel when you get an inkling that you're making up a story without really knowing a lot? I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, how do you deal with it?
Well, I think that the mental habit, at least in my own experience, doesn't go away just because I recognize the futility of it. The mental habit is pretty deeply habituated, and I think the only solution is really to recognize when you're doing it and to not be caught in the story. I think the story building is, at least in my own experience, is going to keep on going. What I need to do is be constantly aware of the stories that I'm building and not be seduced by them. But they're very seductive. I mean, I think there's a whole economy of effort involved in storytelling. You can, you know, you can dismiss whole groups of people if you can build the right story. You can enfranchise whole groups of people by building other stories. You can devalue and value things and thereby make all kinds of life decisions without having to know anything about anything. And so it's for the laziness in all of us, it's very seductive. It's much more difficult to recognize that you don't know anything. And I suppose there's fear associated with that, to be constantly telling yourself, I really don't know anything about what's going on. But the fact is, I don't. I mean, we have a common language, which is very seductive. And I'm looking at you all, and I can immediately start making up stories. I have all kinds of cues in your clothing and what, you know, whether it's expensive or cheap, whether it's bright or hushed tones, you know, my mind just goes crazy. It loves all this kind of stimulus. So I can just start rattling off all kinds of stories. They're all nonsense. But it just seems like as soon as I get the stimulus, I start making the story. So it's not about, I mean, over time, I think you can definitely change mental habits. I think, and the practice really does, I mean, this practice I have found in my own experience does in fact enable me. I have actually changed some of my mental habits with this practice. Not that one. That one's still going on, but I've weakened would be a better word. Not so habituated in certain things as I used to be. Maybe it's the practice, maybe it's just growing older, because they go on at the same time. I can't separate the two. Most of the discussion things that come up have to do with their relationships with the guards. Not necessarily on an individual basis, but on a collective basis. One of the things that goes on in prison is, at least at Soledad, I can't speak for any other prison, is that if there's a violent incident, and I'm not sure how violent is. I don't know what defines. I think a threat of violence is sufficient. It doesn't have to actually be an act. It can be either a prisoner to a prisoner or a prisoner to a guard. If such an incident happens, they will lock down that yard, which means that all the prisoners are confined to their own cells. The buildings are secured on the outside, so within the building itself, prisoners can be confined to their cells, except they can still go take a shower at their appointed hour, but they won't be outside in the yard in the sunlight. They'll be in this darkened building with narrow slit windows, so it's not very well lit in there, and it's all concrete. It's very depressing. visually. But so these lockdowns are not only make it easier to be a guard because now the prisoners are confined to their cells, but there's also hazardous duty pay. So the guards make more money and they do less work. So there are lots and lots of lockdowns. Some of the lockdowns have gone on for 2 months. So I don't, of all of the classes that we've been scheduled to meet in the 6 months that I've been going, I've actually met half of the classes. The other half have been locked down, and we go around to their individual cells and talk to them. So, which is a pretty powerful experience to be in the cell blocks with them talking. We're not actually in their cell, we're outside talking through the door, but you get a much stronger feeling of what it's like being in prison in the cell blocks than you do in the classroom. But so a lot of the incidents that come up in the discussion have to do with things that go on in this environment between the guards and the prisoners, things that guards do to belittle the prisoners, to not honor them as human beings, and how to handle that in the context of Buddhist practice.
What do you do? How can practice help?
Well, I think it depends on the specific incident. As I mentioned earlier, there are two guys in particular, one in two of the different classes, who have a very refined sense of fairness and personal honor. One of them is Hispanic, and the other one is black Muslim. And certainly, my limited experience with Hispanic cultures is not surprising. To find a guy that has this kind of sense of, he has great personal dignity, he's extremely, he honors you when he talks to you, he has this incredible sense of, just absolutely one-on-one, and he expects to be treated the same way, and of course he's not. And he has a really hard time seeing how he's victimizing himself with his inflexibility in this attitude. As the Buddha says that one of the main ways to suffer is the holding to fixed views and opinions. That's one of the four cornerstones for suffering, and he's got it in spades. So, over time, talking to him, because repeated incidents come up over these discussions, begin to try to point this out to him my sense of it is, how do you get him to start to see that and at the same time not throw out his whole sense of personal honor and dignity, which are actually very enriching to him? So I don't think, my own sense is, there's no way to actually logically convince him. It's more a matter of trying to open his eyes to that possibility. That this is where he needs to look at his own, how he holds things and uses things to see if there's a way to alleviate his own suffering. It's not something I can do for him. But most of the things that come up have to do with personal relations. Personal relations in prison are apparently extremely important. I don't know this. I think there are things that are said that suggest that they have everything to do with your personal safety. You don't want to create any situations that involve revenge. There are some side stories that shed light on this. There's a whole, one of the things I found, they have a special needs group of prisoners. Special needs prisoners are, and they actually have cell blocks that are just for special needs prisoners. Well, it turns out special needs prisoners, among other things, include child molesters. Child molesters apparently have no life expectancy in jail. I don't know why that's true, maybe because a lot of these guys have been molested themselves, but they will die. And so the only way to keep them from dying is not to put them in with the rest of the prisoners. So they have that special need. Then they've got special needs that have to do with if you're from Southern California or Northern California, there's a different Hispanic gang that you belong to or don't belong to. And if those gangs are interacting, there's going to be violence. And so they have to sort the whole prison life out in terms of this Hispanic historical background that goes back to something that happened in the 40s in L.A. in the Zoot Suit era. I don't know what it was that happened, but it hasn't been forgotten, and it's still being played out by these Hispanic prisoners that belong to these gangs. I don't know how many Hispanic prisoners belong to the gangs. If it's a majority or a minority, I have no idea. I don't know anything about the causes for this. But this is another group. And one of the things that happened when we went, very early after I started going there, was one of the meetings, the one that we have in the evening, is interfered with by dinner, which there are three or four feedings in this prison, and the prisoners, some of them have finished eating by the time the class starts, but some of them have to go and eat while the class is on and come back. And so we were trying to arrange to get all these prisoners on the first eating shift, the ones that were in the class. It seemed like a pretty simple request, but no, it's not a simple request, because it turns out that in the dining halls, this guard told us basically that the guards do not control the dining halls. The prisoners control the dining halls. And in the dining halls, there are seats that are worked out based on gang membership and I don't know what else. And you can't just randomly move prisoners from one eating period to another eating period without risking their lives. So there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, I don't know what it is, but it's very serious business for them. And when they interact with each other, their behavior, at least in the class, is impeccable. Impeccable. I mean, no one on the outside is that careful, that I, in my experience, with how they interact with everyone. There's no one is carelessly creating enemies, is my impression. There's a chaplaincy program for the prison that covers all faiths, and we are there under the sponsorship of a chaplaincy program. And the chaplaincy office has a full-time chaplain who in one cell block might be Catholic and another one Protestant, whatever, but we're under his umbrella, and he has a couple of prisoners that work for him in the office that put out PR work and bulletins and things like that. And so that kind of communication is handled using those guys who we, you know, over time develop an ongoing relationship with, because we're constantly interacting with them to decide how we want to deal with this problem or this problem, or how do we want to get you know, there's a group of prisoners that have been locked down in one of the cell blocks for a long time, and we haven't been able to go see them because of this, that, and the other thing. And so, you know, there's an ongoing, we do have some ability to communicate using these people. But in general, the prisoners, I think a lot of them come just out of curiosity. The Soledad does not have a lot of programs of any kind. The prisoners that are there who have been to other prisons compare it very unfavorably in that regard. So I think some of them come at least once or twice just as an opportunity to do something different in their lives, and then some of them keep coming.
So do you teach the principles of Buddhism and meditation as well?
Yeah, a typical class period would have fairly short sittings. We have an hour and a half in each of these classes, and there's a lot of discussion. And the discussion seems to be a very important part of it to them. And so we do a short meditation, A couple of the teachers are Qigong, longtime Qigong students, so we do some Qigong movements to begin with to get everybody kind of, you know, there in the room together mentally, and then we do a meditation, and then we may have a short Dhamma talk, working, you know, very careful. I mean, with one group, we've been working on the five precepts for about three months now, because between lockdowns and other things, it's kind of like a precept a night, and it takes a while. So, you know, we have to make notes to ourselves, remember, you know, which precept are we on now? I mean, but we do work slowly through those things, and we've been using Gill's book. It's one of the better. It has the great quality of brevity and sharpness, and we might, you know, we're winging this thing all the time, constantly with these guys, obviously, but we may start actually setting it up and trying to do it as a text. Oriented kind of course. I think some of the prisoners definitely want more of that. And some of them want this discussion. So it's going to be, we have to feel our way along. But Richard, who's been doing this for 20 years, has always felt that, that the discussion is what seems to be what these guys want. It's the opportunity in their lives to actually talk about real personal problems with people who treat them as equals, and I don't want to put too much on this because I'm starting to project again. But you know, I certainly, it's clear that they appreciate the quality of treatment they're getting from us compared to the rest of their lives. Although I think they give that to each other, they don't get it from the guards. They also don't get it from outside in general, I think, because they realize that most people outside have the same kind of ideas about prison that I had. So, you know, what's that like? Excuse me.
Did they take the meditation practice back to their cells and conduct the practice in their lives?
That's highly variable. I mean, some of the guys are very serious. They give me, I have the impression they're sitting every day. Richard tells a story about talking to one prisoner who'd been locked down for 2 months, and he said, "So, how's your practice going? You know, you must be getting really good now. You've been in that cell for 2 months now." And the guy said, "Oh, I haven't been able to practice. I've been too busy." Well, actually, it is busy in there. It's pretty amazing. I mean, when we've gone in and gone around and visited in the cells, depending on what time of the day we hit when we do that, in terms of, I mean, it's the same time of day on the clock every day, but it's a different time in terms of the prison life. And sometimes we go in there and it's totally quiet, and sometimes we go in there and it is incredibly raucous. I mean, these guys are yelling across, this is an entirely concrete room, so everything's echoing like crazy. The room's about half again as far as from here to the far corner there, which the cells all face onto. So there's this huge room with guys yelling. I don't know how they even understand each other, but they can understand each other through these doors. They're closed with this yelling, you know. So I'm sure this yelling has lots of content in it if I could understand it, but it's had its own language. And so there is a lot going on. I can see these guys can maintain a constant state of distraction if they want to. We all do, don't we? I mean, any excuse? Yes?
I just want to say, after all this, that I hope that there would be a day that there's no present. I think it's very torturous, and it just makes me feel very sad. Even though I know some of them are maybe there, maybe they killed somebody or whatever. It's just very sad to think that that's happening. But I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing to have your own going out there. It's like an opening.
Well, you know, I took Ursula down there about a month ago. We just drove by there on a Sunday, and we just drove in and drove around, and she got totally depressed and just looking at the physical circumstances of this place. And And it is, I find that if I want to indulge myself, I can get incredibly depressed and angry about that. But I've also found it interesting that I've actually, I've been much more able to hold this prison situation with some kind of equanimity than I've been able to hold the current political situation. With the political situation, I've had an enormous amount of trouble getting to any level of equanimity. And yet, I'm actually in more personal contact with the prison situation than I am with Washington, D.C. So there's a paradox here, but I think what makes it possible is that these guys, these individual guys that I'm seeing down there, are so captivating that the rest of it just falls away. And what I realize also that's very dangerous about this work is I don't know that it's possible to ever stop going. Because the quality of the relationship with these guys is very special. So I don't know how you kind of resign, you know. Maybe you just die, I don't know. But I found it necessary not to, or at least so far I found it very helpful not to start thinking about the details of what's going on. I mean, my mind can get started. I noticed today in the paper the prison that the state employees are going to get a raise on the 1st of July. You know, there's a whole thing about that, even though taxes, you know, even though we have a budget deficit. And the prison guard union has 28,000 members. Now, I don't know how they're partitioned. These are state employees. The federal prisons, that's a whole other thing. But the state prison guard population is 28,000. I don't know what the prison population is. I have no idea. It's a very big number, though. I think 15% of us will spend some time in jail. I don't know how many. I don't know how that breaks down in terms of 1, 2, 3, 5 year sentences versus lifetimes. Yeah. And it's very clear that this is a custodial duty that they're doing. There's no rehab going on at all to speak of. There's a whole lot that you can get really, really upset about. But I really find that it's not particularly useful to do that while I'm doing what I'm doing. Yeah.
Are there any women prisons that are the women getting help?
There certainly are women prisons. I've heard talk about them, but I don't know. I don't know anything about meditation programs in the prisons. I don't know. I'm sure there has been some passing discussion that suggests that there are people that have done it. Who was talking about? Somebody was talking about a writing program that was going on in a women's prison. Wasn't that Christine was talking about that? Oh yeah, that's right. That was a halfway house. Yeah. Okay. Never mind. So, I don't know the answer.
The same as the county jail in that the prison, the child molesters are kept in a separate place because of what you said, even in the county jail. And the same with the resourcefulness of the prisoners in terms of keeping busy. Most of their busyness is about communicating with one another and trying to see if they can get messages to the outside. And so they spend enormous amounts of time figuring those little slots in the windows. They figure out sign languages so that they can, one person can get a message to the person over here, and then when they walk to the showers, can get a message to the person over here. And then there's
incredible amounts of time writing messages on little tiny pieces of paper that they can pass to one another on the way from the cell area to where they're going to be on trial. These are all prisoners awaiting trial. And so they have incredibly resourceful devices. It's a very creative and keeps them really busy. But it is, if any of you have never toured a jail, it is quite an eye-opener. Just to even what you were saying about you had all these other ideas out there, sometimes I think we owe it to ourselves to do a reality check and just to go and really see and be in those places where we have these ideas or these stereotypes or these kind of blocked notions. Sometimes all it takes is to just go there, be there, and experience something. It's really quite amazing. And for me, an awful lot of sort of insights came about how I'm living my own life. And I remember thinking when I was in there, I'm wanting to move. I don't like my living, blah, 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 and I really would like to move. And we're in this area, and I'm thinking, maybe I'll get some ideas in the next few weeks. So we're in the jail. And I was sort of complaining about the difficulty of finding places around this area. And we get to the jail, and we went to the intake area. This is where people come in, like the street, get booked, and then they are held while, before they go to there's a couple of folks inside that do the sorting, because these are the guards. They sort by gangs because they are very familiar with the gangs, and they know the tattoos, and they talk to these folks, and they absolutely cannot put these rival gangs together because it's just chaos. So they know how to do this. But in this intake area, here came some people, and they were waiting in the intake cell. And there was a woman that had just come in, and she was booked on a DUI. And I thought, and it's a misdemeanor, but she was there waiting. They were deciding where they were going to put her. I mean, this could happen probably to anybody that ever drank a little, even two glasses of wine. But I'm just thinking to myself, you know, there but for the grace of God go several of us. And I thought, isn't that just incredible? And something came to me about how quickly that person's life is. It's not like she's going to go to prison. But the misdemeanor charge meant that she was going to be living somewhere else, and that just, not that I thought I was going to go to jail, but just that whole concept of living in a place where you might never expect to find yourself. It really hit me.
One of the prisoners remarked to me that you know, he was one of those multiple lifers who'd been in a lot of prisons, and he said the most dangerous prisons he was ever in were the county jails because they are so transient that the rules that are established in these long-term prisons to protect everyone's lives, whatever those rules are, I don't know, aren't established in county jails. So there is much more chaos and much more danger. Particularly sexual assault crimes, things like that, because there won't be opportunity for revenge. He said that at Soledad, sexual assault doesn't happen because the perpetrator will be killed, or words to that effect. I mean, so you know that the kinds of ideas we have about sodomy going on and all this stuff. He said that's county jail stuff. That's not going on at Soledad. He said it wouldn't be tolerated. That's just one guy telling me his story. I don't know, you know. I have no idea what the value of truth is in jail, speaking the truth. I have no idea if it has value or not. Certainly you can think of a lot of situations where it would have very negative value. And so I'm never really sure when people are talking outside of this personal experience area, who knows what's their own projections in addition to whatever misrepresentations are going on. I have no idea. Most of the guys aren't, not, of all the guys that I've had personal conversations with, which now would be of the order of maybe 25 or 30, only two of them have said anything about how they got there. Anything about it. And I'm not asking that question. It's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned, but two people have volunteered a little bit of information. So that seems to be something that's not talked about freely, at least. Maybe between prisoners they do, I don't know. So they're... So it's shortly before 9. Should we just sit quietly for about 5 minutes and...